This week's episode of the New in Chess podcast features the fourth part of a narration from The Essentials Sasanko, a collection of chess portraits and stories authored by chess grandmaster Jenna Sasanko. The subject of this week's episode is Latvian grandmaster Mikhail Tal. With his fierce attacking style, the magician from Riga dethroned reigning world champion Botvinnik to claim the World Chess Championship in 1960. Widely acclaimed as a genius, Misha's tactical play would produce numerous brilliancies, as well as a 95-game unbeaten streak, a record that would stand for over 40 years.
Tal had never played the world champion before his match with Botvinnik, and they had only met once, at the Olympiad in Munich in 1958. The story about how little Misha, with a chessboard under his arm, was turned away by Botvinnik, who was relaxing at the Riga seaside, was invented by journalists, of course. Walking between the tables, while his opponent was thinking about his move, Botvinnik asked Tal, "Why did you sacrifice the pawn?" And he received a hooliganish reply in Misha's typical style. "It was just in my way." He liked that phrase. And often when he was analysing, suggesting some unclear sacrifice, he added, "Shall we hooligan around a little?" Tal lost the ninth game of the World Championship match of 1960 after a risky knight sacrifice in the opening. While Misha was tossing out variations in the post-mortem, Botvinnik sat silently and listened. Catching the moment, he pronounced his harsh verdict. "That sacrifice also seemed dangerous to me, but then I realized you have to exchange off the rook and keep the queen." The last words of that sentence became one of Tal's catchphrases, and often, when he was talking about something categorical, he summed up, "Everything's clear, exchange off the rook and keep the queen." He said, "I amnetized him, and he amnetized me about a missed win." He would puff contemptuously when he blundered a pawn at blitz. "Oh, this is nothing. It'll get worse." Playing blitz and sacrificing a piece in the hope of creating an attack on the king, he'd say, "Here are romances for you," words from a popular song at the time. He often changed the third word, "Here are rogues for you," or "Here are teetotalers for you," "Here are Caligulas for you," "Here are dogmatists for you," or anything else that came into his head. "Well now, well now, well now," or "Stop, stop, stop," he agitated during analysis, and staring at the board, started fumbling with his hand in search of a cigarette. "Never mind pondering," he drawled when he was playing through a game, usually by a young player, and this drawn-out pondering was a compliment, and no small one. He often repeated the phrase, "The marasmus is intensifying," and not always in reference to events on the chessboard. Sometimes during analysis he crooned, "Ah, friendship, ah, our friendship, ah, with Romania is strong. If needed, we'll even bring our troops along." That was only in our circle, of course. "And playing like this is what, already banned?" he asked rhetorically, opposing a colleague and making a move that seemed obvious to him. When he saw a retreat by pieces to the last rank, a knight to g8, a bishop to f8 and so on, he commented, "The pieces are getting ready for the next game." Sometimes during analysis he said a phrase, the origin of which I forgot to ask him about. Who was surprised it was rabbits? And only very recently I heard his voice again and the familiar intonations when I found the rabbits in Lettres de mon Moulin, Letters from My Windmill, by Alphonse Daudet. Had these surprised rabbits been imprinted in his memory after reading the book by the French writer, or did the phrase just enter the boundless repertoire of chess folklore of that time? In the magazine Sars, Chess, which was published in Latvia and appeared in Russian and in Latvian, Eivars Gipslis overused the word possible. It was rare that an article or notes to a game by the Grandmaster lacked this word. over analysis suggesting some move or other that carried with it an obvious threat, Misha often explained, with the possible intention of taking on D5, as Avars would write. At the Championship of the Soviet Union in 1977, in his game with Dorfman, Tal managed to develop a dangerous initiative. But the Lviv Grandmaster defended with only moves and took the game to a draw. When the players were coming down from the stage, Dorfman started complaining, "I'm unlucky in this tournament. So many better positions that I haven't won. And yesterday with Geller, I agreed a draw in a virtually won position. But today with us, it wasn't won, I think," Tal remarked timidly. At the end of the Olympiad in Valletta in 1980, he complained that the Soviet team had to play one of the top teams, while Hungary, which was competing with the Soviet players, had been paired with Scotland, which had risen up from the bottom. I consoled him. "Perhaps you'll get Scotland in the next round too." The next day we were both free from playing. He came up to me in the tournament hall. "Look who Scotland is playing," and singing quietly, "She's already in Iran. We're speaking different languages again." He minced towards his team's boards. After losing in the previous round by a large margin, the Scots had been paired with some team from the fifth group. The 17-year-old Garry Kasparov made his debut at that Olympiad. "He already plays so well," Tal commented, "that now he can appear under his former surname without any worries." Kasparov's father's surname was Weinstein, a Jewish name. He adopted his mother's surname. He could be different in day-to-day life. He was far from always in a humorous mood, just waiting to come out with his next joke. He could become withdrawn and serious, pensive. But when he didn't want to make decisions with far-reaching consequences or solve problems that he didn't feel like dealing with, he rescued himself with the first joke that showed up, not burdening either himself or his companion with unnecessary concerns. Thinking back over the time we spent together in the Soviet Union and our meetings on different continents and in different countries, I remember what I didn't know then. In joking, as in drinking, you have to know when to stop. In both cases, Misha often didn't know the limits. By retrieving his habits, his words, and his witticisms, I'm trying to draw a picture of a man who was unlike other people, unlike you and me, at the same time never forgetting that the most important thing that distinguished him from the party clowns and zealous wits who are quick and sharp with their words was his passion for creativity, for self-expression, his chess genius. He had a clear inclination towards literature. It's a shame that when he dictated his articles, Tal didn't manage to talk about chess and about the people in chess without worrying about the obvious restrictions he had to deal with. Would he have managed to do that without constantly restraining himself? I don't know. As external censorship gives rise to internal censorship, and this process can turn out to be irreversible. He once said that if he hadn't been a chess player, he would have probably have chosen the profession of film or theatre director. What kind of a director would Tal have been? There was a time in England when it was commonly believed that Newton and Locke would have been as great poets as Homer or Milton if they had dedicated themselves to poetry from an early age. What would have happened if a red-haired, freckled Osip Brodsky had dropped in on the chess section of the Leningrad Palace of Pioneers on the Fontanka when he was young, and the boy with the piercing stare had preferred poetry? I don't know. Energy and enormous ambition are great driving forces, of course, but most likely we would have lost two giants, of poetry and of chess. When he dictated directly to the newspaper, I saw that sometimes when he began a phrase, he didn't know exactly how it was going to end. But each time, his intuition and talent took him to a happy conclusion, precisely the same way as his genius steered his correct course on the chessboard in his best years. I don't remember him bringing anything on paper. He usually didn't have anything written down with him. Playing with him in some tournaments on more than one occasion, I saw that before the start of the round, he went up to the arbiter's table and took the first available pen. When Spassky was preparing for his match with Fischer, the top grandmasters in the Soviet Union were obliged to give their views about the American, to point out the challenger's strong and weak points. The sport committee's questions were secret, like a great deal else in the Soviet Union, and intended for internal use. Smyslov, Petrosian, Keres and Korshnoi expressed their opinions on this subject. Tal also sent his ideas. His message maintained a tone of soft irony. To take just the beginning, respected comrades of the leadership. Concluding his opus, Tal wrote, "Please excuse my imperfect style and take into account that this work won't be published, except in X plus 1 years in an anthology dedicated to my games." An anthology dedicated to my games? We can't say that he was completely indifferent to what later generations would say about him, but he never engaged in what's known as polishing one's own biography. He once read an obituary of himself that he happened to come across that had been written in advance. He harumphed ironically, "Now I know who I am and what I've done. I can put an official signature on it. True M. Tal." In those days, at tournaments and team practice sessions, all kind of card games enjoyed enormous popularity, including Preference and Belote. There were also bridge fans. I don't remember Misha being at long card-playing sessions. He didn't have the patience for that. But he adored various short games for the reaction and the quick-wittedness, solving crosswords and brain teasers. He liked a game that I first heard of from him. Out of four figures on the number plate of the car in front of you, make 21, using each figure only once. It was difficult for me to check them, but in complicated situations he dealt with square roots, differentials and integrals with a triumphant look on his face. If someone made a call, all the phones in his Riga flat started to click. By the length of the clicks, he tried to determine the number that had been dialed from the next room by one of the residents. He remembered the phone numbers with the help of the musical sequence Do, Re, Mi. He didn't have to be asked twice to sing. In the Brussels bar Select, he performed a song from the repertoire of Louis Armstrong with feeling. Once, an improvised singing contest was set up for the participants in the Interpolis tournament. Of course, it was difficult to compete with the professional, Portish, but the championship was unanimously awarded to Misha, who succeeded with his performance of It's a Long Way to Tipperary. Despite his physical disability, he only had three fingers on his right hand, he played the piano, and not badly. Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, and Chopin were his favourite composers. Sally Landau recalls that on the evening they met, Misha played Etudes by Chopin. A few months before his first match with Botvinnik, Tal asked the famous pianist Bela Davidovich, with whom he was particularly friendly, if she had Rachmaninoff's Elegy in her repertoire. Learning that she didn't, he asked, "Promise me that after my win against Botvinnik, you'll play this piece at the final concert." At that time, in the Soviet Union, there was a custom of holding big group concerts after the official opening or closing ceremonies of chess tournaments. In the evening, after the 17th game, where the score in the match was 10-7 in Tal's favour, the phone rang in Davidovich's flat. "Could you start learning the Elegy?" When Bela Davidovich plays Rachmaninoff's Elegy, she always remembers Misha Tal, and that evening in the Pushkin Theatre, where she played it for the first time. He liked to do impressions, recalling people and circumstances from his own life, in which something always happened. He did a wonderful imitation of the faces of the bank clerks in Canada in 1988. Did they really have to cash cheques for $5,000 and $20,000 for him and Vaganian after winning the World Blitz Championship, And did they have enough $500 and $200 bills for that? Misha always smoked a lot, usually 2 to 3 packs of cigarettes a day, preferring Kent's. But when he was playing, he added an extra 2 to those. An hour and a half to 2 hours before a game, he ate something, but more for appearance's sake. He said very little and withdrew into his own world. He loved everything that he wasn't allowed, of course. Anything spicy, salty, or peppery. He didn't like walking. In 1985, in Taxco, Mexico, he sat for hours with his rum cola on the terrace of the hotel, never going down to the swimming pool, not to mention walking around the lovely little town. Or he read books in his room and listened to the cassettes I'd brought from New York with recordings of the songs of a bard who'd just become popular, singing in Russian restaurants on Brighton Beach in Brooklyn. You love chess. Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way. On-the-spot reports of the biggest events. Top-notch instruction. Independent journalism. Chess history that comes to life. And great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition or the digital edition for phone, tablet or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website, newinchess.com/magazine, for more information about subscriptions and special offers. Two years later, at the interzonal tournament in Yugoslavia's Subotica, neither Bagirov nor I could manage to drag him out for a walk to the lake once in the entire 3 week stay. We endured the final fiasco on the last rest day of the tournament, when Bagirov, after exhausting all his arguments, started saying something about the health benefits of the wonderful sulphur springs that were a stone's throw away. "Ah, sulphur! I've still got that to look forward to," Misha exclaimed, and we were forced to back off. In the small Dutch town of Oosterwijk, where the participants in the Interpolis tournament lived, we sometimes managed to drag him out for a walk. If you could call the couple of 100 meters that separated the hotel from the animal pen that stood right by the road a walk. When the deer, which were trained on delicacies, saw us, they came to meet us and stuck their snouts through the bars of the fence. "What are you doing, my dears? I don't have anything myself. I'm from the Soviet Union," Misha said, throwing out his hands. After standing by the barrier for a few minutes, he looked at us quizzically. "Well, home again? Have we walked enough?" He wrote down his move in short notation, always before he made it. In rare cases, when his opponents seemed too curious, he covered the move he'd written down with his hand. If he didn't like the move, he crossed it out and wrote down a new one. In his later years, alas, he said more and more often, "I even wrote down a winning move on the score sheet, but I crossed it out at the last minute." Once, after a lecture, answering a question about why combinations don't always work, he sighed, "Everyone has a wife who's left them." Satire, in the novel The 12 Chairs by Ilfan Petrov, was the theme of his university dissertation, and it wasn't surprising that Misha often quoted the heroes of the book. I don't remember him telling a joke just like that, although he knew a huge number of them, and he never interrupted a storyteller. "You're not telling it right," picking on a word or suggesting a better alternative. He himself preferred improvisation over borrowed humour. An instant reaction and a sharp jab from a sword were his favourite methods. Brussels, 1987, one of the World Cup tournaments, a late summer evening went on and on at Bessel Koch's party, and I don't remember why, but he asked Tal, "Tell me, Misha, is it true that oral sex is forbidden in the Soviet Union?" Koch wasn't even able to finish the question before Misha replied with perfect pitch, "No, Bessel, it is not forbidden. It's just not recommended." I first saw Tal outside Russia in January 1973 at the tournament in Holland's Vijkenzee. I gave him uncensored Russian ditties to read, a collection of risque rhyming quatrains. He flipped through them, hemming and hawing. Suddenly he laughed. How lovely! He very much liked that phrase too, and often repeated it. How lovely! What, Misha, what? Listen to this. It's from the foreword. The compilers turn out to be serious people. The third type of ditty, quite similar to the second, speaks of the poverty of collective farm life, and in general about the unproductiveness of collective farm work. Included here are ditties about bad food and its catastrophic effect on the genitals. Or this, the fourth type, which also touches on collective farm life, is united by the important category of solid excrement. And, bursting out laughing, he repeated, "No, how lovely! These will probably be the best ditties. Researchers, son of a..." But he didn't like to swear. Sometimes he only whispered or more often mouthed unprintable words. However, he didn't mind other people swearing, and he calmly endured my tirades on this subject or that. Reading Vinishka Arafeyev's Moscow Petushki, he laughed about the recipes and names of the cocktails. Canaanite balsam, young communist girl's tears, and bitchy tripe, commenting on the author's advice to drink more and eat less. We know that! It wouldn't be true to say of him, "My only books were woman's looks." But it was a fact that he preferred women's company, lively surroundings and the warm essence of life. The television was hardly ever turned on in our home, his wife Gelia recalls. We subscribed to almost all the publications that came out in the USSR. When he was here, he read them from cover to cover. What to say here? A television in the Soviet era, not turned on all day. A magazine from that time that was read from cover to cover. That doesn't mean, though, that he spent long days and weeks poring over newsprint. The speed of his reading was amazing, and on more than one occasion, I saw him finish a bulging book in literally a day or two. In January of 73, during the tournament in Vijkenzee, we spent the night before the rest day at the house of a friend in The Hague. "No, just you listen, Michel, to what the old man wrote in 18, especially as you live on Gorky Street. You'll remember it when you're walking home." It was late at night, but I started reading out loud particularly strong anti-Bolshevik parts from Untimely Thoughts by Gorky, which were completely unlike his Song of the Stormy Petrel, which everyone studied at school in those days. A couple of minutes later, silence descended, and I sensed, rather than actually seeing, the absence of a reaction. The cigarette in his hand had gone out, and Misha was sleeping peacefully, having laid his head down on the sofa bolster. Now that I was in the Western portion of my life, I knew that when I went somewhere for a tournament, I should take as many books as I could with me that were banned in the USSR at the time. At the Olympiad in Nice, 1974, in the evening, I gave him the just-published Gulag Archipelago by Solzhenitsyn and the latest issue of a Russian emigre newspaper. In the morning, giving everything back to me, he said, "I couldn't find a single word in the newspaper crossword." "Well, and the book, the book?" "Solzhenitsyn writes very viciously." In The Hague, we saw The Godfather, which had just come out. Although Misha was suffering from being unable to smoke and anxiously awaited the intermissions, he watched the screen with great pleasure. In general, he liked films on dark subjects and novels with strong plots. If his mind didn't seize on something instantly, he didn't want to get his teeth into it, rationally believing that a book should give pleasure and not be a torture, and he moved on to something else. He didn't collect any kind of books, of course, just as he didn't collect or hoard anything in life. It was so much useless reading matter, so much burdensome knowledge. What was the point of such a pile of baggage when the trip was so short? Once in Tilburg, he asked for something to read, as always. Knowing his partialities, I gave him John Barron's book, KGB, The Secret Work of Soviet Secret Agents, which had only recently been translated into Russian. The longest chapter in the book was dedicated to Larissa Sobolevskaya. This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Discover your perfect chess friend. The DGT Centaur is a chess computer that automatically adapts itself to your playing strength. It gives you a fair chance to win, to learn, and most importantly, to have fun. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl. A beautiful, elegant blonde, a former actress and first category chess player, never without a cigarette in her hand, and absolutely not an abstainer from strong drink, Larissa S. had been Misha's girlfriend for several years. She played one of the main roles in a grandiose KGB provocation, the aim of which was to blackmail the French ambassador to the Soviet Union. The KGB created a cover story for Sobolevskaya, according to which she was married to a geologist who spent most of the year in Siberia. The actress coped with her task superbly, becoming the girlfriend of the ambassador, who was accidentally discovered one night in his own flat by her husband, also, of course, an employee of the State Security Service, after which the ambassador endured pressure and blackmail. 2 days later, returning the book to me after reading it and saying, "Can you find something else?" Misha made no comment on its contents, as if someone else had spent several years with one of the main heroines of the narrative. We admit, though, that in their joint Moscow period, Tal wasn't very strict in his attitude towards other female admirers of his talent. Throughout his entire dissolute life, he expressed the unshakable certainty that someone should care about him, take care of his business, and help him out of difficult situations. Osip Mandelstam wrote of the 17th century French artist Claude-François Vignon. But Mandelstam himself constantly had someone by his side too, sometimes friends and readers, and always his wife, constantly thinking about him, living with his problems. All decent people happily serve her. They do the washing, the heating, the cooking, carry water for her, give her papirosi, matches, firewood. Lydia Chukovskaya wrote of Anna Akhmatova in her Tashkent evacuation. Calls at any time of the day or night with the request to visit immediately or simply with other requests are mentioned in every volume of her memoirs, and there were no occasions where Chukovskaya, sometimes offended and in tears, would have refused the poetess, as she accepted it all as her duty, and she was carried away by a line from Pushkin: "Other people caught animals and fish for him in their nets." Joseph Brodsky wrote, "How many nonsensical things I have to do all my life, paying taxes, adding up whatever numbers, writing recommendations, vacuuming the flat. Tal didn't do any of that. Other people did it for him." In Chile Petrograd in 1920, Mandelstam, rushing out into the corridor, started banging on all the doors. "Help, help, I can't light the oven. I'm not a furnace stoker, I'm not a boiler man, help." Misha wouldn't have started shouting and begging. He would simply have curled up in the corner and waited until someone warmed up the flat. And the fact that he torments those around him and gives his tenderness to his poetry, replacing poetry with chess, the same could be said about Mikhail Tal. Tal's wives and girlfriends testify, being with him was a difficult job, without holidays or weekends, daily and hourly challenges. Misha demanded unconditional loyalty to himself, which meant being by his side at any time of the day or night. "If he doesn't want to eat, that means I should also die of hunger, roaming around Riga with him. If he's giving a simile to children, I absolutely have to be there if..." recalls Sally Landau. he completely took people prisoner, subjugated them to him, while at the same time remaining kind and sympathetic in his own way. That was the case in 1969 when, during the national championship, he moved from a hotel to the home of the pea couple. For the refined peas, who worshipped Misha, this was a real disaster. Having turned themselves into guileless and willing sacrifices to him, they had to completely rearrange their lifestyle to suit Tal, not to mention the constant calls for an ambulance. Albert Kappengut recalls, when something good, something pleasant had to be conveyed, Tal did this himself. In reverse cases, Misha transferred this onto the shoulders of Gelya or someone else. Leonid Shamkovich was Tal's second in 1965 for his match with Spassky in Tbilisi. He recalled that Larissa S. tenderly took care of him, brushed his hair in the mornings, fed him with a spoon, and so on. I observed scenes of that kind also when Misha was with the Larissa M. She, too, had to be by his side all the time. So it wasn't surprising that when Koblenz suggested before the match with Botvinnik that Boleslavski could become Tal's coach, he refused point blank. Tal doesn't need a coach, he needs a nanny. Alexei Suetin. He never asked for help, but usually he had very little interest in what others were doing, ignoring complaints of unfairness even from those whom he considered friends, which is to say, like all to whom fate is kind, he was subject to egocentrism. I also heard similar comments from Koblenz, who doted on Tal and loved Misha like a son. On the whole, Tal was indifferent to people. Someone who doesn't lift a finger for himself is even less likely to do anything for others. All this is a commonplace truth for those who revolve any time in the orbit of such stars. Only a clear understanding of the person to whom fate has led you forces you to voluntarily endure a lot of things that you would inevitably oppose if they involved anyone else. Day-to-day life with a genius is immeasurably more difficult than life with an ordinary person. A genius, like anyone else, can be self-obsessed, inattentive, capricious, mistrustful, or irritable, and only after his death, when the trumpets start to resound and the insults are covered with haze and disappear, do the things that only those who were close to him knew and went through go somewhere far away, and now become so unimportant and insignificant. And it seems that the time that was spent with that person was real life, and now all that's left is remembering and describing the happy times of the past for others.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. We thank our voice actor, Nick Murphy, our producer, Alex Pollock, and of course our sponsor, DGT, for their support, and hope to have you back soon for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.